What's up, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Lights Out. I'm your host, Josh. I'm joined in the studio by my co-host, Austin. How's it going, man?
It's going good. What about you?
Living the dream. Nice. Living the dream. Another snowy day here in Colorado.
Yeah.
After a blizzard last week. I'm pretty tired of it at this point.
Yeah, when does it end?
It doesn't end.
Okay.
It could be May and we'll have a blizzard.
I think last year we had a snowfall in May. Yeah.
It just gets annoying after. I mean, we shouldn't be complaining. You're from Michigan, so.
Oh, it's way worse there.
Yeah. This is nothing.
It's 100 days of shadow and snow.
There's no. It's like Alaska. It's like just pitch dark.
Yeah.
But today we are not joined by Danny. He is out sick with something. I don't know what it is, but hopefully he's okay. No, he's okay.
He's blowing up the bathroom or something. Yeah.
But no, he's doing well. He'll be back next week. But instead, we're joined by our cinematographer, one of our senior producers who works on many of our more long form projects here, including our documentary, and potentially our first Lights Out. I don't even know what to call it yet. It's not really a documentary. It could be a special. It could be a show. It could be a movie. It could just be three guys lost in the woods.
Sitcom.
Our first comedy special. But Tom is here.
Hello.
Hey, Tom.
Hi, Austin.
You will probably be seeing more of Tom, especially as we start putting together our project here. Which, thank you to everybody who reached out from a couple weeks ago. You know, we were looking for anybody who's got connections here in the Colorado Denver area for haunted locations, and you guys came through big. And so we're talking to a couple different people, and we're trying to figure out what something would look like, where we would go. So we have a lot of cool ideas kind of brewing, which I'm excited about too.
I'm really excited too.
Get out of this hellhole that we're in every week. No, love the studio, but these chairs are really uncomfortable.
Oh, they're awful. Like, I mean, they look sweet, but they're
literally the worst.
I feel like this is like the electric chair. This is kind of how you're sitting. You've seen those old school like wooden electric chairs that it's just completely upright.
You just need like restraints on the
that would be me.
But speaking of the electric chair, you know somebody who should get the electric chair?
Who?
The guy we're talking about today.
Good segue.
We're talking about a real life monster today, a monster that roamed the woods of Canada, and scary individual for sure.
Yes.
If you've never heard of the Wells Gray camping murders, then this one will probably make you think twice about camping. I love camping, and I've always felt safe camping. I don't know about you.
Same. I've never thought that just a strange man would come out of the woods. And now I kind of have that in the back of my mind.
I think it's something good to have in your mind.
Yeah.
Because whenever you get out there in the middle of nowhere, I think it's part of you is like, okay, I'm away from people.
Yeah.
So there's nobody that's going to bother me. You're like, you're thinking more about bears or mountain lions.
Yeah, definitely.
Or wildlife than you are a psychopath lurking in the woods.
Right.
But I think, man, this one definitely hit home, and I for sure will be heavily armed from now on every camping expedition, because you just never know. And in this case is absolutely horrifying. So let's go ahead and just dive right into things here, shall we? So for this episode, we're going to take you back to the 1980s here. In August 1982, 44-year-old Bob Johnson was excited about a two-week camping trip he was about to take with his wife Jackie, who was 41, his daughters Janet and Karen. Janet was 13, Karen was 11, and they were also bringing along Jackie's parents George, who was 66, and Edith, who was 59, and they had this big family extravaganza out in the beautiful woods. I mean, this area is absolutely stunning, so I can totally see why this would be a destination for a family camping trip. George and Edith were delighted when their daughter Jackie invited them to go, as Jackie was an avid photographer and she loved nothing more than taking photos, especially of her family. She was also described as always smiling and for being soft, warm, and nurturing. I mean, this is, you know, a typical family. I mean, very similar to all of our families. So I definitely relate with this. I have so many fond memories of going in the woods with my family and family camping trips with the grandparents and stuff. I mean, I feel like camping is just such a great bonding activity.
I love it. My mom hates camping, so we never went. But since I was in Boy Scouts and later in Eagle Scout, I went camping with my dad all the time and the scouts and stuff. But we would go to a lake house or something with my mom.
She's like, I need a nice bathroom, a hot shower.
Yeah.
I'm not rough in camping or whatever. Her husband, Bob, was known as a down-to-earth funny guy who loved practical jokes, but would give anyone the shirt off of his back. He was also a proud family man, an avid motorbike enthusiast, and a hard worker who was well-respected at the Gorman Brothers Lumber Sawmill, where he had worked for 25 years. I always find that impressive when hearing about people who have worked for the same company for 20-plus, like their whole career. That's just like not a thing anymore.
It's like impossible to do that now.
Yeah, it is pretty much impossible.
You got like pensions back then and whatnot. But my dad worked for Chrysler for 20 some years.
So really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah. My grandfather worked for I think it's a Bell telephone company before they became something else Quest. I think they eventually became Quest, but worked for the same company his entire career. Lived in the same house that he still lives in today, 50 years.
Wow.
In the same house.
That's crazy.
Blows my mind. I'm like, wow. Just could never imagine that.
Yeah. I guess my parents are on their way because they've lived in the same house in Michigan for 37 years or something like that now.
That's so impressive.
36 years.
I feel like I could never do that.
Yeah.
I get like tired of my house after like 2 years. I'm like,
Time to pack up.
Yeah. Kendall hates that. She's like, Don't ever say that. We're staying in this house for 20 plus years. Yeah. I'm like, all right, I should probably stop because
moving is a pain.
It is a pain.
I like the idea of living somewhere else, but moving is the worst.
It is. It is like hell, basically. But the Johnsons all lived together in Kelowna, British Columbia. Their daughters, Janet and Karen, were happy and bubbly girls who got along well and liked to stay active. When they weren't at school, they could often be found practicing piano, working on a new badge for Girl Guides, which is the Canadian version of Girl Scouts, if you didn't know, and fishing and camping. By August, everything was set for a perfect trip. The family had planned to meet near Wells Gray Provincial Park, a massive wilderness park located in east central British Columbia, about 5 hours northeast of Vancouver. It'd be everyone's first trip to Wells Gray Park, and they couldn't wait to break in the new truck and camper and explore the old prison ruins nearby. So that takes us to August 2nd, 1982. Bob, Jackie, Janet, and Karen set out on the two-week camping trip with Jackie's parents, George and Edith. The group traveled to the remote Wells Gray Provincial Park in British Columbia, Canada, which covers over 1.3 million acres, making it British Columbia's fourth largest national park. That's a lot of land. Wells Gray is almost twice the size of the entire Greater Vancouver area. It has gorgeous mountains, rivers, creeks, and iconic waterfalls, but the park is still primarily uninhabited wilderness and is not meant for amateur campers. The Johnsons had packed most of their camping gear in a carrier that sat on top of their 1979 Plymouth Caravelle. George had recently retired from his job, and he had just purchased a brand new 1981 silver Ford pickup truck and a 10-foot Vanguard camper. According to their entire family, they all preferred to camp away from groups or large crowds, which... Same. I can't stand crowded campgrounds. It's just not enjoyable.
It always breaks my immersion with nature when it's like the campsite nearby is like blaring music or something.
Or like a generator going.
Yeah, like, it totally takes me out of it.
Yeah, just you want to be able to hear nature.
Right.
And it's hard to do that when you've got Led Zeppelin playing next door to you and, you know, people getting rowdy, which, you know, we all like to get rowdy in the woods, but not when we're right next to each other. Right.
Right.
So they would often ditch the established campsites for dispersed camping a little more off the beaten path. They picked an old abandoned prison site for their camp spot. It had been cleared of dirt and debris and was relatively flat and dry. They thought it would be the perfect place to set up camp. And the first night had been warm and starry. They all sat around the campfire and made plans to go fishing the next morning. Karen and Janet had been worried about their dog Tyke, who had gone missing from their home a few days before they had to leave Kelowna. Jackie had reassured them that he was probably safe and would be back home waiting for them when they returned. First thing the next morning, the girls got in their swimsuits and waited for the adults to finish cooking breakfast. After eating, they spent the rest of the morning exploring the woods, and later that afternoon, they all went fishing. The girls both caught a small fish, and on their way to show their parents, they saw strange movement in the trees that overlooked their campsite. They figured it must have been some kind of animal rustling around, so they didn't really give it much thought at the time and just kept on walking back towards camp. That night, they all sat around the fire again and talked about everything they had seen and done that day, and everything they wanted to do the following day, which included exploring the old prison ruins to see if they could spot any ghosts. Edith, the baking enthusiast, suggested they head out bright and early the next morning so they would have enough time to gather some berries to make a pie. The next day, the girls tried their hand at ghost hunting before setting off for a few hours to go berry picking with their grandmother. Later in the evening, they headed back to camp to have dinner with the rest of the gang. After they ate, the girls changed into their pajamas and then came over to roast some marshmallows by the fire before turning in for the night. About 30 minutes later, they were jolted awake by a loud bang. They heard screams and shouts, making it hard to understand what was going on before they heard two more deafening sounds. Someone then approached Janet and Karen's tent. She could barely make out the silhouette of a figure in the flickering of the light of the campfire. Janet went to unzip the tent door, thinking the figure might have been her mom, Jackie. A loud crash rang out, and Janet watched in horror as her mother collapsed to the ground. Both girls screamed as they saw another shadowy figure approaching from the side of the tent, and that's when a strange man peered his face through the opening and looked directly at them.
On August 23, 1982, Al Bonar, the manager of Gorman Mills in West Kelowna, British Columbia, made a call to the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, or the RCMP, to report his employee, Bob Johnson, as missing. He told the officer, quote, "Bob hasn't taken a sick day, let alone missed a day's work by just not showing up in 20 years. He mentioned Bob had gone camping with his family to Wells Gray Park 2 weeks earlier and never came back. The officer forwarded the missing persons report to Sergeant Baruta in Clearwater, who checked the local park and businesses for any signs of the missing family. Clearwater is south of the park. It's basically your last city before heading into the park, especially if you're coming south. Extended family from the Bentley side also handed out photos of their missing family members around the area. And speculation buzzed about their disappearance, ranging from joining a cult or a commune to simply just getting lost. Either way, the most expensive missing person investigation in Canadian history was about to begin. So the first lead came from a local gas station about 40 miles east of Clearwater. The attendant recalled seeing George and Jackie with the girls. They had stopped at Avila Petro-Can to refuel the truck and asked about good places to pick some berries. The police launched their search, but after weeks of effort, they came up with nothing. Then, on September 13, 1982, a local mushroom picker named Kurt Crack spotted Johnson's car while out foraging in Wells Gray Park. He described it as a burnt-up Chrysler located just off Battle Mountain Road. Police headed to the spot Crack indicated, and from the road, they could see tire marks skidding off into the brush. Following the tracks, they stumbled upon a burned car. As they inched their way closer, they could make out the license plate number, and when they ran the plates, they discovered the car was registered to Bob Johnson. When they glanced inside the car, they discovered the skeletal remains of four adult bodies in the back seat. If these were the missing family members, this meant the girls, Janet and Karen, were still missing, so police immediately roped off the crime scene and called in the homicide team. The ground around the car was scorched. The vehicle was so badly burned that the door handles and all four tires had been completely melted. All doors were found closed except the driver's side door, which had been left open. The trunk was also closed, and when investigators got close enough to look at the lock mechanism, they noticed what they described as a, quote, dusty type of smell. So they used a crowbar to pry open the trunk, and inside, they found the skulls of two children looking up at them on what appeared to be a pile of charred bone.
Can you imagine that?
Sounds like something out of a horror movie, honestly.
That is so terrifying. I mean, it's very clear that the fire got up to an extraordinary heat level to the point that it's melting tires. It melted the glass even, and it essentially reduced all of these bodies to a pile of ash. I mean, we're talking like a crematorium level,
right?
Almost. It's crazy.
And if you can imagine, they had fit all four remains of the adults in the back seat of this kind of small Chrysler, you can kind of imagine how much they had been burned down to. A prominent hole could be seen over the left eye area of one of the children's skulls, which would later be identified as a bullet exit wound. The forensic team later opened up the skull and they actually found the bullet, which was submitted to the lab. The pathologist working on the case found remains of a scalp in the well of the back seat that also had a bullet in it. The identities of the bodies were later confirmed through matching medical and dental records. George, Edith, Bob, and Jackie were found charred beyond recognition in the backseat of the Johnson family's vehicle. Janet and Karen's bodies were in the trunk. And like Josh was saying, it was pretty clear that the killer used some type of accelerant to start this fire because it was raging enough to melt glass. Roughly 10 days after the bodies were discovered, their family held a funeral service on September 23rd at St. Paul's United Church in Kelowna with over 300 attendees. For police, the next priority was to find the Bentley's missing truck and camper, which led to their first tip. And this would be one of many tips. A local resident on vacation in Saskatchewan immediately recognized the camper and truck after seeing pictures on the news and followed it to the gas station where they saw, supposedly, two men get out. The witness said they were French-speaking men in their late 20s. They were poorly dressed, they had long, unkempt hair, and the smaller of the two was blonde and the larger one had dark hair. In response, police made an exact replica of the Bentley's truck and camper and drove it across Canada to potentially attract attention to the case.
Yeah, which I've not heard of police doing that before.
Kind of a strange tactic. I don't really understand yeah. what they're accomplishing.
Well, I think they're hoping that if people see this exact replica, it's going to like trigger a memory for them. Because also on the truck, they have big signs that says like, have you seen this vehicle? It's associated with this family that was murdered, you know, call with any tips.
That makes sense then with the signs and everything. I guess that is a way to attract attention.
Well, and then they drove this truck from BC all the way to Montreal and back.
Wow.
Which is quite a distance. And, you know, I don't know how that's all that helpful to go so far away from the murder scene. Yeah. But I think at that point they're kind of desperate for, you know, they're worried the case might go cold. They're kind of running out of clues. And so it's kind of like a last ditch effort to try to drum up some more credible tips. But yeah, I've never seen police do this before where they're driving a replica of a victim's vehicle around. But
yeah. And unfortunately, nothing came of it until a witness from the Wells Gray area called in. They remembered seeing the same truck and camper parked at the, quote, Old Bear Creek prison site, which is about 3 acres. And when detectives investigated the old prison site, they found plenty of physical evidence left behind. They found 3 canning lids that matched the canned goods found in the Johnson Scorch car. They found extra old stock beer bottle caps and an unopened extra old stock beer in the nearby riverbed. And this was actually the brand of beer that Bob was known to drink. Spent .22 caliber casings were also found, along with a campfire pit with 6 chairs and 2 small sharpened marshmallow sticks. So it was safe to say they had found the family's campsite and the murder scene, but unfortunately there was still no sign of the missing truck and camper. In January 1983, several cash rewards were offered. One was for $35,000 for any information about the truck or camper, or about any information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person responsible.
I'm kind of thinking they're so keen on finding this truck and camper, because I think along with the other tip of the two Frenchmen, they're assuming that whoever murdered this family has gone on the run with this vehicle, perhaps.
Right.
And so that's kind of their thinking, is like they did this, they ditched the other vehicle, burned all the bodies, which it's like, why didn't this person go and clean up the campsite and take all the evidence that would obviously give away where the murders took place and burn that along with the bodies?
That's a good point, because it's like they clearly had enough time to do it. And I don't know, maybe it's they knew something about if I return to the crime scene, I might get caught because the police might be there, something along those lines.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, it kind of speaks to the killer's thinking a little bit of like, how well thought out was this? You know, did they really like pre-plan this, or was this kind of a spur of the moment thing that just kind of unfolded? And then, you know, for fear of being caught, they, like you said, just kind of hastily got rid of what they thought was the most crucial evidence, being the other vehicle and the bodies, but not thinking, is there other ways for them to link this crime back to this location? And maybe they just weren't thinking the location mattered at all. Like,
yeah,
it wouldn't necessarily tie them back, which we'll find out later on.
Yeah. I do think it's a good point though, that this is a new truck. This is a 1981. This is 1982, which is, it's taking place. So maybe the killer was like, yeah, I'll just snag this for myself and fix it up, change the plates, whatever, try and scrub the name off of this car. Who knows?
I mean, that's a major risk, and it seems like a that's doing a little too much to just take someone's vehicle. Like, if you were there to just get the vehicle,
why not just
like hold them at gunpoint, rob them, and then take the truck,
right?
But to like murder the entire family in the way that they were, and then burn all of them and ditch the other vehicle. I mean, I think that speaks to there's some other motive going on here for someone to take it that far. Today's episode is sponsored by a brand that has had a major impact, and a positive one at that, on one of the most important things in my life, and that is my cat. I absolutely love my cat, Tucker. I have two others, two females named Meatball and Lily, that I've had for a long time, but Tucker, he is our eldest pet in our house, and unfortunately, he's been having some health issues. I actually had to take him to the vet this past week because he has had serious diarrhea and serious vomiting, and I was very concerned about him because this was kind of like out of the blue. So I took him to the vet, and the vet was like, all right, we've got to do an ultrasound because it's one of two things. Either he has basically intestinal disease or he has lymphoma. So obviously very scary, and luckily he does not have lymphoma. They did the ultrasound and he does just have intestinal disease, which is still no joke. It's serious.
Is it curable?
It's not curable, but it's manageable with medication. So he's on a medication now for that. But one of the big changes that my vet recommended was his diet. One of the other big things that was happening with Tucker is that he was losing a lot of weight. He's a tiny, tiny guy. He's only like 5.8 pounds, which for an adult cat, that's pretty small. And again, he's always been a small cat, but the vet was concerned he's losing weight. So he's like, really want to get him pumped full of protein with a new healthy cat food. And that's where our sponsor Smalls has come in big. Smalls cat food is protein packed, and it's made with preservative free ingredients that you'd find in the fridge. And I love that it's delivered right to my door. All my dogs are on a really good quality food, and I've been waiting for a good quality cat food to come out there. A refrigerated one that I know is made with good, good ingredients that's going to actually put meat back on the bones. And Smalls was started back in 2017 by a couple guys home cooking cat food in small batches for their friends. And a few short years later, they've served millions of meals of cats around the world. They have a bunch of different blends. He loves the poultry bird blend. You know, it just comes in these little packets, you put in the bowl, and he absolutely loves it. It's great for his teeth aren't in the best shape, so it's easy for him to eat it without, you know, causing pain. And after making the switch to Smalls, 90% of cat owners reported overall health improvements, and that's a big deal. I'm really hoping that this will help get Tucker back on track, hopefully add some more weight to him. Along with the medication, I hope I'm going to have him for many more years to come, which is the good news. The prognosis looks good. So I'm very happy that Smalls has come through to help get him back on track and also sponsor the show. And what's great is that the team at Smalls is so confident your cat will love their product that you can try it risk-free. And that means they'll refund you if your cat won't eat their food, which is a great assurance as a cat owner because cats are picky and they don't always like it. So you have that. It's 2024. Are you still feeding your cat kibble? Head to smalls.com/lightsout and use promo code lightsout at checkout for 50% off your first order plus free shipping. That's the best offer you'll find, but you have to use our code LIGHTSOUT for 50% off your first order. One last time, that's promo code LIGHTSOUT for 50% off your first order plus free shipping. By the end of April 1983, the case seemed like it was going cold until a mechanic in Windsor, Ontario called in a tip, and he claimed that two men drove up to his shop in the middle of the night. They had just unloaded their camper and were looking for a quick paint job for their truck, and they offered him cash to do it. Which is a bit sketchy. If you're going to be like, oh, I just need this quick paint job on this truck, I'll pay you whatever you want to make it happen. The two men waited the entire time while they were repainting the vehicle. And after they started talking, they even showed off their .22 caliber rifle and a handgun. They said they needed to get rid of the weapons and asked if he knew any place they could offload them. And he ended up sending them to a place across the United States border in Detroit. The mechanic also described distinct modifications that were made to the front and rear bumper of the truck, which happened to be identical to George's. But sadly, after police followed up on the tip, it led nowhere. Eventually, police finally caught a promising lead. Two forestry laborers stumbled upon the abandoned vehicle on October 18, 1983. It sat along an unused logging route near Trophy Mountain in close proximity to Wells Gray Provincial Park. And similar to the Johnson's automobile, it had also suffered significant fire damage. Detectives were baffled. They thought they had searched that entire area before. When police first flew over the location, they only spotted a truck. No camper or boat could be seen. Once they arrived at the scene, they saw what was left of the charred camper and truck. It appeared the driver had attempted to drive the truck off the edge of the canyon that was only a few feet away from the truck, but it had gotten stuck. They figured whoever dumped the truck must have been from the Clearwater area, since the maze of roads used by loggers was confusing to outsiders, which I think is very applicable to pretty much every major area of, like, here, national park land or just public land owned by the government. I mean, not all of it's very well mapped, and there's all kinds of little side roads and loggers roads.
Yeah.
Or just that staff used for, like, cleaning up the forest and stuff. So
right.
To know how to find a good spot to hide this vehicle, I think that was a good assumption to make that
he's a local.
Must have been a local, which is like, why wasn't that like the first thought?
Right.
Yeah. They like automatically assumed that they had left the area.
Yeah.
But yet, I guess they did look kind of, but it's like, why wouldn't you go down every logging road like in this, you know, in so many square miles of where this murder took place.
Yeah, initially. Instead they're heading out to Montreal with the truck and camper.
Yeah, wasting a lot of time driving lots of miles for no reason.
And then Windsor is so far away. So they're picking up a tip from Windsor. Like, that's so far out. I mean, maybe. I guess they really didn't.
Well,
everything's clear in hindsight, right?
Yeah, but, and on the flip side, I guess I kind of understand. If nothing like this had ever happened before in this area, you might assume that it must be somebody from out of town that came in, did this, and then left again. Like, why would anybody commit such a heinous act and then stay there?
In their own community.
In their own community. Like, what are the chances of somebody being able to do that and get away with it for a long period of time? So maybe it's just kind of like, you know, having sort of that perspective of,
yeah,
like,
or maybe they're naive. They're like, there's no way we have a local person in our community that could do something like this. It has to be an outsider. So right. Yeah, maybe it's something like that.
Well, and I think they were initially pretty confident in their searching abilities too. They're like, we flew over this area, and
right,
like, which again, from the air flying over this foresty area, not gonna be able to see a whole lot.
Yeah.
I'm just like, these vehicles were torched with accelerant. How did nobody report a fire?
Right. Yeah. Especially since this is a logging community, wouldn't a forest fire be a major concern here?
Yeah. How did a forest fire not start because of this? That's mind-blowing too to think about. Investigators discovered a .22 caliber bullet hole in the passenger side door, and they found the bullet casings in the grass nearby. But they initially kept this information hidden from the public so they could weed out any false confessions or bad tips in the future, which
smart.
Was a smart move for sure. The news coverage following the discovery of the truck was harsh. People felt that the local police operation, quote, ignored the fundamentals of a homicide investigation. authorities hadn't concentrated all of their search efforts near the area where the family went missing, and the public critiqued them for being too distracted by fake tips and false leads. This case would end up taking in about 13,000 tips, which,
that's crazy.
To their credit, have they ever had a case of this magnitude before and dealt with 13,000 tips? I mean, and the pressure of the public. So you're going to be like, we got to figure this out quickly. And all these tips come flooding in. How do you know? It's really kind of hard to say if a tip's fake or not legitimate until you actually like investigate it.
Yeah. It seems like a local police station that's just overwhelmed with something like this, a case to this magnitude. And like 13,000 tips, to put it into perspective, I think the city of Clearwater has like 2,000 some people in it. So the amount of tips that are coming in are like five times the amount of even the population of the closest town. It's probably hard to wrap your head around as a police station who probably not dealing with something like this ever.
Right, right. Well, and also too, I think people were like, how come nobody never came to talk to us? Like right after this family's reported missing, how come it took them so long to begin doing door-to-door canvassing, right? Like they really just kind of got thrown into this. And I think we're overwhelmed with all the tips and information and, you know, the geographical area and the fact that people are seeing the truck and camper elsewhere, that they forgot to like do the very basic thing of, well, let's rule out this entire area first. Not only doing physical searching, but let's go talk to everybody in the vicinity of this park, or, you know, where the family was camping. Because it wasn't until, you know, they started getting the negative response and the pressure's really on and they find the truck and now they still don't have a culprit that the police are like, okay, we should probably really go talk to everybody now. And that's when I think they said they had like 75 different officers and investigators assigned to the case at that point. It was like all hands on deck to figure out who did this. And, you know, that's when they started going out to every single house. They're like, I don't care if it's a 90-year-old or a 9-year-old kid, like bring them out. We're going to talk to them. We want to know, which is very thorough and what they should have done from the jump, because it might have led to the answer much sooner. So it was during this time that a local waitress slipped a note to a policeman. The note had the name David Shearing written on it. She told him that he was a, quote, bad dude and they should look into him. That's all it took. A local waitress to slide it. It's like, that's why the locals, that's why the people of the community, it's like, don't assume that somebody from outside the community could be somebody
right here,
right at home. Yeah.
I also think that's such a like Newark crime scene. Like the officer like smoking a cigarette at the diner and the waitress like slips him a note.
Oh, totally.
Just the name David.
I'm sure that's exactly how it went down.
Yeah.
You want some pie, sir?
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah.
Like, here's your check. And then underneath the check is
the note. Yeah.
Look into David Shearing.
Yep.
But not only that, during one of their door-to-door interviews, a witness also mentioned David Shearing's name to detectives. They had heard a rumor about David Shearing committing a hit and run on the Wells Gray Highway and killing someone a few years before the Johnson Bentley murders. It's like, why wouldn't you go ask the locals? Like, is there anybody here who might be capable of this crime?
Yeah. And clearly everyone's like, yes,
it's actually David. Yeah. David up on the hill there.
Yeah.
Bad dude.
Yeah.
Literally hit and run, killed somebody, was never caught. Go look at him first. Yeah. It's such a shame that it took so long for them to figure out the suspect, David Shearing. And then the following day his name came up again during one of their door-to-door searches. At one of the homes, an elderly man answered the door and denied knowing or seeing anything regarding the recent murders. However, his wife interrupted and asked her husband, quote, you're not going to tell him about David Shearing and the truck that got shot up? I was just like,
there you go.
And I can just like see this all playing out in my head and, you know, the wife's back in the background doing something like, you're not going to tell. The officer's at the door talking to the husband and he's like, nah, stop talking.
Yeah.
It's none of their business.
Right.
Because, I mean, in a lot of rural communities, people don't like to be bothered and, you know, people either have a really good relationship with law enforcement in those communities or they just can't stand
for
law enforcement. They don't want to help them and everybody just kind of keeps themselves.
Yeah.
And so the old man said, I told you everything we're going to tell you. And so the officer was like, all right, that's all I can do. And he left him his card and headed back to the station. They plan to wait until the husband left before going back to bring the wife in for questioning, because obviously they're hearing David Sheeran come up again, and you know, they want to talk to her. She obviously knows some stuff. She ended up confirming that David Sheeran had asked about how he could re-register a Ford camper truck and how he could fix a bullet hole in the door. All very suspicious.
There you go, and we got our guy.
Like, a massive tip. Yeah.
That's it.
She also told them David lived out on a ranch off Wells Gray Park Road, which is just 2 miles from where the murders took place. Since it wasn't known to the public that a bullet hole was found in the truck's door, David Sheeran became investigators' prime suspect.
And like we were saying, that was a smart move for them not to talk about the bullet hole. And there it is. It came back.
I mean, they needed a win at this point.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
that was a smart thing to do.
I know. This is like, it's funny how quickly everything adds up. They're like, oh, let's go talk to the locals. Boom. We got them.
It's like, why? Just when they go missing, why wouldn't it be investigators' first thought? Well, who's in the surrounding area?
Right. Yeah, it is. It's almost suspicious.
It is.
At how stupid that is. And like, obviously, it's a small town, and there's kind of a stereotype of small towns of like, everyone kind of hears all the rumors. Everyone's kind of in each other's business because there's just only so many people around. So
use that to your advantage.
Right.
Why not? At least like rule those people out before you drive all the way to Montreal in a replica.
Right.
Truck camper, like,
and some people in Windsor trying to scapegoat Detroit first or something. Get out of here. Also, yeah. I did want to say fun fact. Fun fact of the day, I will say.
The Motor City.
If anyone asks, yeah, it's a little Detroit fun fact. If anyone trivia, if you're at trivia and someone asks, what's the most northern country that is south of the continental US? The correct answer is Canada. You normally think, oh, Mexico, right? Because that's directly south. It's the most north, directly south. But it's Canada because Windsor is actually south of Detroit. It's like a little leg that sticks out.
Right.
So it's technically south of the US.
Which,
in one area.
Fun fact, have you ever heard of the Windsor Hum?
Yes, I have. There's actually, funny enough, there's a post-punk band called Proto Martyr. And they used to practice in the same warehouse that we did. And they got pretty big, but they have a song called Windsor Hum.
Are they the cause for it?
Yeah.
Is it just some band in a warehouse?
Yeah.
Overblown speakers?
Yeah. But yeah, the Windsor Hum. I'm surprised you know that. That's like a local thing.
Yeah. No, that's we covered that story on Mile Higher a few years ago, actually.
Oh, really?
And that's actually, I actually knew that about Windsor, that Windsor's south of Detroit.
Yeah. Across the river.
Yep.
All right. Sorry about my fun fact. Yes.
Back from trivia now.
Yeah. So who is David Sheeran? David William Sheeran was born in 1959, and he was raised on the same 160-acre cattle ranch where he lived his entire life. He was the youngest of three kids, and in grade school, he was said to have been very shy, but pretty advanced in mathematics and especially mechanics. He graduated from Clearwater High School in 1977 and enrolled in a heavy-duty mechanics course at Caribou College in Kamloops, where he planned on getting a job.
Is there no more Canadian name than Caribou College?
Right, yeah.
In Kamloops?
Yeah. But David, you know, he, for whatever reason, I think he was just getting into trouble. He really couldn't hold down a regular job. Instead, he found a group of like-minded people who would just steal tools and work equipment from construction sites and resell them to make some money.
Oh,
pretty scummy.
We all
way.
Hate thieves,
yeah,
man.
Especially thieves that steal tools. Come on. I mean, I know why. It's really easy, but scummy. In 1982, David's father died of cancer about 4 months before the Wells Gray Park murders, and this was when David reportedly started drinking very heavily, and meanwhile, his mother was living in a retirement home, and his brother Greg was actually a local sheriff.
So, not suspicious at all.
So remember that. From the outside, David appeared to come from basically a nice, you know, quote, normal family who lived on just an isolated cattle ranch. But it was clear that David was a little different from the rest of his family, and he had been in trouble with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police many times. Possession, assault, driving under the influence. Investigators also heard rumors that he enjoyed the company of underage girls around the age of 13 or 14. So
scummy.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
And it seems like everybody knew David was a pretty suspicious guy.
After several delays due to bad winter weather, authorities arrived at Dawson's Creek by November 19th. This is where David would take the bus to work construction with his friend Jason Hill that afternoon. And they were the last two off of the bus and were surprised to see the police waiting there. The officers asked them if they would step over to the police car for a few minutes. They offered to drive David down to the station because they wanted to talk to him about a few things. He reluctantly agreed. When they arrived at the interrogation room, he appeared nervous and began chain-smoking cigarettes. After answering some preliminary questions, David randomly asked them, "Are you guys investigating the Johnson-Bentley murders?" They asked if he was familiar with Battle Mountain. David nodded his head yes. Police then asked if he knew that that's where they had found the dead family's truck, camper, and car. And he did. Detectives then asked him what he thought about the Johnson and Bentley murders and what he thought about them being killed near his property. Just come right out and say it, I guess. And he admitted that it was, quote, pretty bad for the community. They then asked if he knew where the car and truck were found, and he nodded. Finally, they asked him if he knew where they were killed. And when he said, quote, "Yeah, the old Bear Creek campsite," detectives are like, "Holy shit,
this
is our guy.
Yeah.
How does he know this?"
It's so specific.
Because the public had never been told exactly where the murders had taken place. So
right.
To name it down to a T, like exactly where this site is. I mean, that was like, must have been a huge moment for them. And once David realized that he just had to give himself up, tears rolled down his face. The lead detective asked him if he knew they would be coming for him, and he said, yeah, I did. And that's all he said. They asked if he knew what made him do it, and he said, no. They asked if he remembered it well, and he admitted that he did. When they asked, quote, "Where did you first see the Johnson-Bentley family?" he said, quote, "Down at Bear Creek, where they were murdered." He also confessed that the boat and gun were on his property and offered to draw them a map to where they could be found. He told them they could find the murder weapon, his 22 caliber Remington Model 572 pump action rifle, on the gun rack in the front room of his house. The boat was discovered underneath some bushes, and all the equipment, including life jackets, were hidden underneath the boat. According to David, he had spotted the family's truck and camper on his way home from work, and that same evening he decided he'd go for a walk that ended at the campsite where he had spotted the campers earlier. He moved around the brush until he found a spot that looked down over the campers. David watched the campers for a while until he got spooked that one of them had spotted him. He ran across a field and hid in some shrubs for about 15 minutes to make sure he hadn't been followed, and then he walked back home. The next night, he returned to the campsite, but this time he had his 22 caliber rifle with him. He claimed he followed the same path, but instead of hiding, he walked directly into the campsite and started firing. He also drew another map that showed detectives where he ambushed the family, which was through a dense grouping of bushes adjacent to the campsite. David also admitted he couldn't remember who he shot first, but that it was one of the four adults that were sitting around the campfire. He fired several rounds from between the truck and the tent, killing the adults. The tent was just right of the camper, so he approached the tent, crouched down, and shot Karen and Janet before loading all their bodies into the car. He also claimed to collect all the family's belongings and toss them into the camper. He then placed the bodies of the adults in the backseat of the car, and the two girls into the trunk. He said he moved the car, truck, and camper a couple of hundred feet away, and when he returned the next day, he rummaged through the car and took anything he wanted to keep, and then drove the car to Battle Mountain. David admitted that he poured gasoline inside of the car and used a piece of paper or birch bark to light it on fire. He apparently watched everything burn for a while before heading home. 2 days later, he returned to the truck and drove it up to Trophy Mountain, but it got stuck, so he torched it where it stood. Police noticed a detail missing from his story, though. That bullet that had been fired at the passenger side door. David initially played dumb when they asked him about it, so they moved on. They asked if he had any more of the victim's belongings, and he did. He had actually stolen their camera, which Jackie often used, and he admitted he threw the film out and burned it with the camper, along with the fishing equipment, but he kept the spare tire and stored it alongside his boat. Detectives could tell there is so much more to the story than what he was letting on, and David would later admit much, much more. He eventually explained that he had first seen the family and that he was sexually attracted to the two young girls. When he returned the next day, he admitted he knew he was going to have to kill the other four members of the family in order to get to the girls. That night, he watched them for about 45 minutes before one of the women spotted him. When she stood up in a panic, David rushed forward and yelled, "Don't move, I got a gun." When Bob quickly stood up, David remembered he must have shot him in the throat because he was gurgling and making a lot of noise. George made a dash for the truck, but he was shot next to the passenger side door. While Jackie headed for the tent, he shot her in the head about halfway between the fire pit and the tent. David then made his way toward Edith, who was trying to get inside the camper, and he'd recall coming up behind her and shooting her in the head too. Once they were all dead, he went over to the tent. He said the girls were inside, sitting up on their elbows, and asked him what all the noise was. He told them there were some bad people out there, and that their parents told him to stay behind while they found help. The girls asked him if, quote, it was motorcycle people, and he confirmed it was before saying, "Whatever you do, don't come out." Then he went back outside to shoot Bob again because he was making too much noise. Then he put the bodies in the car, covered them up with a blanket, and took a few minutes to clean himself before heading back to the tent. Once inside, he sexually assaulted both girls.
After he got himself dressed, he had the girls help him take down the tent. All the while, they kept asking where their parents were, and he told them they had gone to get some help. Then he told them to help him clean up the rest of the site by putting everything inside the camper. He then led them to the car and told them to sit next to him in the passenger seat as he drove them back to his ranch. When they arrived, he told them to pitch their tent. He also told them that the, quote, biker people were still looking for them, and to stay safe, he warned them they weren't allowed to leave his property. After that, David said he walked back to the campsite for the truck and camper, then drove it to what he thought was a good hiding spot. When he returned to the ranch, he told the girls that he had saved their parents and helped them escape. David believed the girls then saw him as their hero. He reminded them that there were bears, wolves, and bikers out there, and they would get them if they ever attempted to flee. He said, quote, "They were scared shitless and would do anything I wanted them to, and once they were settled in the tent, I went back home." The next morning, he went to work as usual and left the girls alone until he returned with bread and milk. After a few days, he insisted that they left the ranch and made their way through the dense brush in the middle of the night, and that it was, quote, raining like hell. He said he had tried to make a fire, but failed, so he covered the girls with a sheet of plastic he just happened to bring with him. He also claimed that the girls slept in one sleeping bag, while he respectfully slept in the other. The following day, he traveled through the woods until they came to the river that led to his fishing cabin. There, he said he hung up all their wet clothing and sleeping bags. However, he also claimed that he slept in a separate sleeping bag from the girls that night, but this didn't really add up since he said the sleeping bags were still hanging out to dry. What do you think of all this? Do you think he's trying to cover his tracks because he's already admitted to sexually assaulting them? And now he's trying to, it almost seems like he's like trying to backtrack where he's saying like, no, now we're sleeping in separate sleeping bags. I'm respectfully giving them their space now. Why do you think he's doing this?
I think he's just trying to save his own ass at this point. And yeah, either that, or maybe internally he's like struggling with the things that he did and he's trying to minimize his actions to police, to try to make it seem like, oh no, you know, I'm this heinous killer, but I would never I would never do this to young girls. I was kind of there protecting them. I think it's just him trying to make himself feel better, but also he's trying to manipulate the police into making them think, well, I'm a monster, but not all the time.
Right. Yeah.
You know, it's like, but I don't buy any of it. I think he's just,
yeah, I think he's trying to rewrite the story. And unfortunately, all we have is his story. This is just one of these cases where the murderer is, we either have to believe him or not. But
you really think we're going to believe that?
Right.
After you everything. Really just killed this entire family in cold blood.
Exactly.
Burn them. What you have on your mind is respect and care for these young girls. Come on, man.
Such a lie.
I mean, it sounds like one of those like guilt things though, you know, where it's like kind of like when you're a kid and you like accidentally like break a plate or something. You're like, oh, mom, I broke a plate. That's what you should say. But then in your head, you're like, oh, well, the dog made a noise. That kind of spooked me. I bumped into the counter. My elbow hit something. I didn't realize it was a plate. I swiped my arm. The plate fell off. It's broken.
Yeah. You know, it's just this whole like elaborate lie. Yeah. That he needs to.
Like, I honestly wonder how much of the detail is like actually accurate detail. And there's another part of me. It's like, I wonder if like he just did the act, went to one location and then just killed them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It almost sounds like he created this fantasy in his head, like this fantasy story, because he clearly sees the girls and that's when the fantasy for him starts. He's like, okay, these are the victims. These are the girls that I want. And in his head, I mean, he even talked about having dreams and stuff. So he's clearly, this is something he's been thinking about a long time. And so I think a lot of this could absolutely just be complete bullshit made up. And like Tom just alluded to, this was very fast, very simple. And, you know, the girls weren't even alive during this period of time that he said they were.
Right.
They were already dead because I mean, think about the type of person to not only do this, but then to be like, okay, I've just done all of this. Now I'm going to go spend a week with these girls and it like have this fantasy life where we just forget about their family and they become my wives or whatever sick fantasy he was trying to contrive. I don't know.
And it almost doesn't add up. I don't think, you know, Janet and Karen, they seemed like they were kind of independent. They would go fishing. They had all these ideas. They were adventurous. I don't see them as like this strange man who now their family is dead. And they know they had to have seen that.
They heard the screaming. They heard,
and they had the gurgling, like, you know, he's like dragging the bodies and stuff. I think they're still smart enough to know what's going on. And for me to believe that David takes them to his property and says, hey, set up the campsite here and stay here while I'm also going to like go and leave for a while and I'll bring back bread and milk. I don't think these girls would just be like, yeah, okay.
Yeah, they're 13, cool. 14. Here. Like, that's old enough to know you're in danger.
Yeah.
And I mean, they had to have known what had happened to their parents.
Yeah.
And that's why it's hard to believe that this just went on as long as he's saying it did.
Right.
Have you ever tried to break a bad habit and felt like you're climbing Everest in flip-flops? I think we've all been there. But here's a breath of fresh air. Fume. It's not about giving up. It's about switching things up. Fume takes your habit and simply makes it better, healthier, and a whole lot more enjoyable. Fume is an innovative, award-winning flavored air device that does just that. Instead of vapor, guess what? Fume uses flavored air. And instead of electronics, Fume is completely natural. So you don't have to find that pesky charger you're always losing in order to use Fume. And instead of harmful chemicals, Fume uses delicious flavors. And they got some very unique flavors for this flavored air device. We're talking maple pepper.
Yum.
Which I get it. I mean, have you ever had like maple pepper bacon?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Those two work together.
Yeah, true. A little smoky, too. Get some smoky.
Smoky sweetness going on. I personally like the crisp mint. I love minty flavors, mint ice cream, mint everything. So they also have a bunch of lemon flavors, orange, vanilla, grapefruit, raspberry, lemon, white cranberry cores. And they're coming out with more flavors as time goes on. But these devices are truly unique. I've never seen anything like these before. Think of it like a refreshing cup of tea, but you're inhaling it through this Fume device. The feel of this device, it's well weighted, it's well built, it's got real wood, it's perfectly balanced, and it's fun to fidget with. So not only does it take care of that hand and mouth fixation, but also if you're a fidgety person who likes to just fidget with little things, this thing is a ton of fun. It's also a great conversation starter because a lot of people are going to assume it's, you know, a different kind of device, but ultimately you can be like, no, check this out. It's a multifunction habit breaking tool. And it smells and tastes good as well. So it's a win-win. So start the year off right with the good habit by going to tryfume.com/lightsout and getting the journey pack today. Fume is giving listeners of the show 10% off when they use our code LIGHTSOUT to help make starting the good habit that much easier.
The next day, Sunday morning, David apparently woke up to find a guard and some prisoners fishing in the river nearby. And I guess the prison guard had approached his property and told them that's what they were doing that morning. And apparently the two girls were behind the door that David was kind of hiding them, shielding them, so the prisoner guard never really saw them. But that made him panic and relocate the girls back to his ranch. And one of the lead investigators, Mike Eastham, actually confirmed this and tracked down the prison guard where this exchange did confirm to happen. Not long after they returned, David asked Karen to go for a walk with him to talk about, quote, a personal matter. She followed him, and once they got out of range from the ranch, he stopped her, told her that he had to take a piss, and made her turn around. Little did she know that, I guess he had been hiding his .22 rifle stashed behind a tree, and when she wasn't looking, he took the rifle, shot her in the back of the head, and left her body there. When he went back to camp, he cracked open a beer and sat down for a while. Jenna then asked him, where's my sister? Where did Karen go? And he told her that he had tied her to a tree. So being an avid outdoor enthusiast, Janet would have known that, you know, either my sister's still out there and she's not going to survive being tied to a tree, or something wrong is going on. So this story just is weird and doesn't add up at this point. That night, David claimed it was just him and Janet alone in the camper, but that she was a virgin and didn't know much about sex. So again, out of, you know, quote, respect, they just talked most of the night, according to David. That Tuesday morning, David said he asked Janet to go on a walk with him down the trail. And when he got to the spot where he hid the rifle, he asked her to turn around so he could, quote, take a piss, just like he had done with Karen. And when she turned around, he also shot her in the back of the head. Afterwards, he claimed to load up the girls' bodies in the trunk and then went home and took a nap.
What?
Yeah.
This doesn't make any fucking sense.
This doesn't make
any sense. What is up with this thing of, I'm going to take a piss, you turn around?
Yeah, I don't get that.
So that doesn't even make sense.
He already admitted to sexually assaulting him, but was like, don't watch me take a piss. I don't get this.
I'm just
going to
stand here like you're standing. All right, I'm going to piss, you turn around. I'm just going to piss right here.
Right.
That, like, the behavior doesn't really add up to what's typical, but
no.
Maybe he's not the typical guy.
Right.
And maybe he gets, I don't know, maybe this is something he does in front of people all the time. And I just feel like this is a very strategic part of his story to try to make it seem like there's some, he has some mercy, or like he's doing them a favor by not just like killing them face to face,
right?
And like, I'm gonna make them turn around so they don't see it coming, type of thing.
Yeah,
or maybe he doesn't want to see it because he feels bad. I don't know. I just don't buy really any of this story. Yeah,
it's just sounds like a lunatic writing, trying to like rewrite history of what happened here, and none of it makes sense.
It's like a sick, dark fantasy that he created in his mind.
Yeah, the thing that sticks out to me is that he was like, oh no, they saw me as their hero. I saved him from this like fake biker gang. I brought them food. Like, so I think this is all furthering his fantasy, is that this confession.
He's
like, no, I'm actually their hero as well, on top of everything that happened.
Right, which makes no logical sense whatsoever.
No.
And according to police, David's account of everything that happened was a stretch, to say the least, and they didn't believe his story was credible at all. When David explained his motivations, he later admitted, quote, I don't know what happened to me. It's like everything in my mind was gone, and all I could think about was those girls. I've had dreams both in day and at night, but nothing like that happened that day. As much as I didn't like what I was thinking, I couldn't stop it.
That might be the one truthful thing that I might believe that he's saying.
In a later interview, David would also confess that after killing the adults and going into the girl's tent, he told Janet, the older of the two, to tie her sister's hands because she was frantic and kept yelling for no reason, which that right there kind of proves our point that we're making. Like, these girls know exactly who this guy is.
Exactly.
He's no hero. They know he just killed their whole family in cold blood. If the younger sister's freaking out, I would like to guess that Janet was probably also freaking out equally as much.
Yeah.
David said, quote, I wanted her to remove her clothes so I could make her feel good. I wasn't hurting her, just feeling her. The other didn't understand it and kept crying, so I had to put something in her mouth. When asked by police if he raped them, he replied that, quote, couldn't get it up. Sick.
Yeah, boy.
According to David, he then told the girls to get dressed and stayed inside the tent until he called them. He wanted to make sure all the bad guys were gone, but he had chained them up in order to keep them safe, as he said. David also changed his version of the story again, saying he had apparently become friends with the girls, which, yeah, right, dude. Don't believe that for a minute. This is pretty disturbing, but several years later, police would find the initials DS plus JJ carved into the wood at David's fishing cabin, which obviously stands for David Shearing and Janet Johnson.
Do you think that's proof of her being there? Or do you think he could have just carved something in? Or do you think it could have been a local carving that in?
I think it's probably just him having one of his sick fantasies playing out. Or maybe he saw them that night. Or I guess he would need to know her name, so it would have been later on.
True.
After he talked to her. But yeah, I think that was probably him. Which I think just leads, he's playing out this, like, oh, this young girl, she's going to be with me. I'm going to win her over type of thing. I don't know.
Yeah.
David also explained that Karen, the youngest, wasn't understanding what he was wanting from her. And he said he tried so many times, but she would always fight with him. He claimed he wanted to make her happy, but she just wouldn't listen and would always cry. With all of his confessions and conflicting stories, it's almost impossible to know truly what happened to the Johnson and Bentley families. And today you can find a fence and a sign at the old prison site that reads, Ministry of the Attorney General, No Trespassing. On the other side, you can still see the clearing the family used to set up their camper and tent, and even remnants of the fire pit.
Yeah, so this is a brutal one. There are some theories that kind of extend off of David's confession, but there was some speculation that David did not act alone. Some wondered how he could have, gathered up all the bodies, put them in the car, burned them, also burned and hid both the vehicles by himself. I was always thinking, if you drive a car out somewhere and burn it, is he just walking home along these logging roads? Because wouldn't that be like eyewitnesses would see him walking across the road? Or is he calling someone to be like, hey, come pick me up in the middle of nowhere? Suspicious activity, but maybe there's someone else with him that drove a car alongside him and then they drove back together. I don't know.
Or he just knows this area so well that he's doing all this in the dead of night. When nobody's up.
Oh, yeah. That could have been the case.
My guess is that's when he burned the vehicles, is at the middle of the night when he knew people wouldn't be awake to see the smoke. The fire would be out by the morning. And then he just walked back, probably through the trees and knew how to evade not being seen by
anybody. That's a good guess, actually.
I mean, this is a big area of wilderness. So,
yeah.
Not out of the realm of possibility, but just loading up four adult humans. I mean, heavy. It's a lot of physical exertion going on.
Right.
But again, like I brought up earlier when talking about this before recording, is he's a career criminal. So, I mean, for all we know, this isn't the first time he's done something like this before.
Yeah.
And so he's just kind of, it just doesn't faze him. Or he gets like an adrenaline rush from this and he's just like, on a mission when he kind of gets in this zone.
Definitely possible with one person, but seems
pretty difficult.
This crime would be way easier with at least two people. Others thought that someone else could have maybe hired David to take out the family, but why? I don't really buy that theory because as far as I know, nobody had motivation to kill anyone in this family. According to David's mother, though, David had received help from his brother, Greg.
Ooh.
That's his own mother said this.
Yeah, that's pretty interesting.
Greg Shearing was a sheriff in Prince George, British Columbia, and he also quit after his brother was arrested and charged with murder. Prince George isn't that far from the Wells Gray Provincial Park. But many tips the police received suggested that his brother Greg helped David burn and hide the evidence after the fact. So even some of the tips that were coming in, obviously, 13,000 tips, people would probably say a lot of things in there, but it is interesting to note.
But why would he do that?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, right. What's the motive for him to help his brother?
It's a good question. Other
than to protect the image of the Shearing family name, perhaps, but why would you put your whole career and life on the line to help your brother with this?
I would love to know their relationship a little bit more. Unfortunately, I couldn't find any more information on how they were as brothers, how close they were. I'm not sure, but I have no idea. But the fact that their own mother was also throwing him under the bus.
I mean, that tells you a lot right there.
Yeah.
Not a great family dynamic there.
Yeah. Another possibility was that the police possibly lied about what really happened or about what David actually told them. And many locals believed he didn't act alone or that the local police were somehow involved, which I don't know. I mean, I don't want to get on my tinfoil hat, but it is really suspicious that they didn't first go door to door like we were saying. Why did they not? Because clearly they would have immediately found David Shearing if they had just done that.
Just asked if went to the diner.
Yeah.
Got some coffee and had a waitress slip.
That's all it took. Yeah. So it seems like basic, very easy investigation and basic protocol were kind of surpassed here for whatever reason. Maybe it's just incompetence. I don't know. But something to think about at least. And we also have to keep in mind that Clearwater, British Columbia, only had, you know, a few thousand residents at the time of the murders, which was, you know, small enough for everyone to know everyone's business, like we were saying earlier. But unfortunately, until more solid evidence is found to prove any of these theories either way, we have to just assume that, you know, David acted alone and purely out of sexual desire. That's all the hard evidence we really have to go on.
One thing I did want to mention, though, is that one of the RCMP officers who was investigating this, he did mention that he's had multiple run-ins with David Shearing in the past, which is also interesting that that name wouldn't have just like popped into your head
right
when this happened. Like, who in this area is a career criminal?
The constant
a violent
troublemaker.
Past.
Yeah.
And he even mentioned that there were multiple occasions where he, you know, he would potentially enter into shootouts with David Shearing, and that he had like goons, like a couple guys that he would hang out with and do some of these crimes with in the past.
Yeah.
So it's very possible that one of these like goons of his helped him with this, but yet that was never really investigated at all. And nobody else has been held responsible if they were involved with this crime at all. So
seems like there's some missing puzzle pieces here for sure.
So that leads us to April 16th, 1984, and that's when David Shearing pled guilty to 6 counts of murder. Supreme Court Justice Harry McKay characterized the act as, quote, a calculated and purposeless elimination of 6 vulnerable and blameless individuals. David was sentenced to 6 concurrent life sentences with no chance of parole for 25 years. This was the harshest punishment possible for second-degree murder, and this also marked the first time it had been given in Canadian history. 3 years after the trial in 1987, the Shearing house mysteriously burned to the ground. There was never any explanation or reason given as to why, and a rumor spread that it was set on fire by angry citizens who lived in the area. Or, down the rabbit hole, maybe people were involved, covering up evidence or involved. And
yeah,
I think there's more to the story here that's not being told.
Agreed. Also, where is the evidence? If he's confessing that he did bring the girls back to this ranch and their tents were there and he shot them there.
Where's all that
physical
evidence?
Yeah. Well, did that come into play at all? Or was it just like, hey, oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. And he pled guilty. So let's just move on. And we don't really have to explain anything else.
Yeah. None of that is out there anywhere, is it? Like, did they actually do a search of the house? Did they look through his stuff? Did they actually try to confirm any of his claims?
No idea.
It's all very bizarre.
Yeah.
And this is equally as bizarre, but as a lot of killers do, they get letters from people in prison. And David started getting letters from a woman named Heather from Prince Albert, Saskatchewan. And in 1995, that pen pal relationship turned into a full-blown marriage. David married Heather. Heather claimed her husband deserved a second chance. She said, quote, I have seen so much change in this man since we met. I know the man's heart is in the right place, and I'm just here to back him up. I will never understand this weird romantic obsession with killers. And
we've covered this before in some episodes, and I think it's popularized as Bonnie and Clyde syndrome.
But how is it Bonnie and Clyde? What, you're hoping he gets out so you can go commit crimes together?
Like, yeah, I have no idea. But it's actually called, I looked it up, it's actually, we've covered this, it's called hybristophilia, where you're sexually attracted to criminals. But yeah, it's a big thing. And like, serial killers constantly get love letters in the mail. Doesn't matter who they are.
Or how heinous the crimes are.
Yeah.
This dude committed heinous crimes, not only against adults, but children.
Yeah.
And you somehow think it's a good idea to
get married
to this guy. Like, this is the
I cannot
man of your dreams here. Like, what?
Yeah.
Yeah. And apparently they're allowed conjugal visits and stuff. So they've definitely had physical interactions and encounters and in prison. But that's a weird way to have a marriage, I guess. I don't know. It's just my opinion. But David ended up ditching his last name in exchange for his mother's maiden name, Ennis. I assume he wanted to distance himself from Shearing, so he now goes by David Ennis. But David first qualified for early parole eligibility in 1999 after serving only 15 years of his sentence. What?
Yeah, so I actually...
How's that even possible?
I looked into this because I remember I was like, no, they said it was 6 concurrent life sentences. And which I also found out, I think a life sentence in Canada is something like, it's like 25 years or something, yeah, which is crazy. But then they were saying he couldn't have parole until he served 25 years. So I was like, well, how was he up for parole at 15 years? So I guess this doesn't exist anymore, but there was a faint hope clause in the Canadian Criminal Code. It's basically, it allows prisoners who have been sentenced to life imprisonment with a parole eligibility period of greater than 15 years to apply for early parole once they have served 15 years.
As a faint hope.
Yeah.
Like what?
I don't know. Maybe they're thinking like, oh, if they're an absolute saint in prison, the rare chance that it seems like they are rehabilitated.
I wonder if anybody's ever been released
successfully
on parole.
I'm not sure.
After 15 years. I'm sure there is probably.
Yeah. But offenders who committed their offense after December 2nd, 2011 are no longer eligible to apply for the faint hope clause. So okay, it doesn't really exist anymore. But in his case, it would have, which is why he tried to apply after 15 years.
And thank God the parole board rejected him.
Yeah, definitely.
Because I mean, just because you can apply for parole doesn't mean jack shit, really. Yeah. Like, you most likely, especially for these crimes, are not going to get out. In September 2008, he was up for another parole hearing, and the National Parole Board ruled that he still possessed violent sexual fantasies and hadn't completed sex offender treatment. So a no-go there. He had also officially been diagnosed with sexual sadism disorder, which is where a person inflicts pain, humiliation, and fear to achieve sexual gratification. Another parole application in 2012 was also rejected. A petition against his release with 13,258 signatures heavily swayed the parole board. Which, I mean, goes to show petitions do work sometimes, especially in the case of keeping a monster locked up. David applied again 2 years later in 2014 and withdrew the request a month before the hearing. In the meantime, online and paper petitions received 15,258 signatures, which desperately urged the parole board not to release him. During his 2021 parole hearing, the parole board witnessed the same pushback. Actually, I have a clip of a childhood friend of Janet and Karen talking about his potential release. Go ahead and take a look at that.
They call themselves an army. Their artillery, sadness, resilience, and anger. Family, friends, and a community fighting to keep the man who robbed them of 6 lives behind bars, but also to keep their loved ones' memories alive.
I hope that they know that we're never going to forget, and that we're never going to let people forget, and that as hard as it is for us, it's not as hard as what they had to go through.
And here's Janet and Karen's cousin, Shelley Bowden, talking about it as well.
Which, by the way, that was their childhood friend named Tammy.
Yeah.
In that first clip.
It relives everything over and over and over again.
This is Shelley Bowden.
And it's killing me. It really is. It's heartbreaking.
He's in his 60s. He could do it again.
Many of the extended family members have expressed how exhausted they are with the parole process, which rightfully so. I mean, it's just brutal to every 2 years have to come out and make a case for why this monster should never be released. And David had actually expressed interest in living in a neighborhood close to another one of Janet and Karen's cousins, Crystal Wolf, once he got out. Well, that's kind of creepy.
I know. And I don't know if that was just a coincidence, like if he had the information that she lived there. Probably, I would guess it's probably a coincidence, right? Yeah. But still, like,
how would you feel, like,
on your conscience with kids? She has children too, and just thinking about that he's in the neighborhood.
But also during his hearing, David told the parole panel that he had sexual fantasies, including rape and murder, beginning in his mid-teens. He apologized for his actions, which was the first time that he had done that. And by the time of this hearing, he had completed sex offender programming, which who knows what that means.
Yeah.
Is there any information on that
out there? I looked it up, and I don't know. Unfortunately, I don't know the specific sex offender programs that he went through in this prison. But it seems like the whole point of it is to, you know, limit or stop reoffending, to try and get people to control their impulses. Sometimes they have medication, SSRIs, certain things that will ever kind of help them suppress these feelings and try and rework that. That's as far as I could kind of find. Unfortunately, yeah, like I said, we don't have the specifics into what he actually went through.
David also admitted that when he saw the family's vehicles parked near the campground, that's when he began stalking them. He said the only one he was interested in was Janet, and he killed the adults because they were simply in the way. He said, quote, "I saw them as just a means to an end. I saw the four adults basically as being in the way of what I wanted at the time. It was just Janet, as far as I was thinking, and Karen just happened to be there." Oh, God.
It's brutal. That's a double-edged sword, because he's finally just admitting what really was going through his mind, but it doesn't make it any less horrific.
No, not at all. It almost makes it worse.
Yeah.
And just being like just random. I think it just goes to show how demented this guy is and how strong that urge for him is.
Yeah.
I mean, that statement right there, to me, if I were a judge, I'd be like, this guy
absolutely
can never,
yeah.
If that's all it took for this guy to murder six people, how do we know? How can we assure the public that this is never going to happen again?
Oh, right.
Man. In 2021, another petition was started to encourage the parole board to prevent the release of David for his upcoming hearing, and it reached over 101,000 signatures. So there's a lot of people that have rallied behind this family, and quite honestly, probably just don't want this dude ever to step foot out of prison, because he's a danger to society at this point. His 2021 parole was denied again in the interest of public safety, thank God. He still has the option to apply for escorted leave, but it's unclear if he ever will, which that's an interesting thing to offer somebody like this, escorted leave. I don't think anybody gets that here in the U.S.
No.
Unless it's like a funeral or something, or like, but right. Even then.
We did cover that case of Vince Lee, which was another Canadian case, and I remember he got the escorted leave before they just released him completely. Pretty controversial in my opinion.
They definitely do things a bit different in Canada than they do here, and definitely are a bit more lenient with the sentencing and the privileges they give prisoners who are dangerous.
Yeah, and I like the idea of leniency, especially with nonviolent cases.
Right.
But man, in the case of rapist and murderer, I don't think that's the time, really.
But as of today, David Ennis, formerly known as David Shearing, remains incarcerated at Bowdoin Institution in central Alberta. He is 64 years old currently. David will be eligible for parole again in 2026, and some question the morality of allowing a mass murderer to be paroled after killing six innocent people. Like, shouldn't it just be no parole at this point? Like, life without parole, but I guess in Canada, they don't do that.
And I think it was a sentencing issue, right?
And it was a second-degree murder charge,
exactly.
A first-degree murder charge, and they already kind of extended it as far as they could. So I guess I get it, but still sucks for the family. I mean, it's terrible. Following this case, police have apologized and taken responsibility for their negligence during the searching part of this investigation, which has now made the department more aware of fake or useless tips. How about just canvassing the area,
God,
asking people in your tiny town?
Yeah.
You know anybody that could have done this, but I'm glad they took responsibility for it. I think that's a good step in the right direction, but is there more to that? Maybe, maybe not. In 2016, the Johnson Bentley family and friends helped change legislation so that mandatory parole reviews are now every 5 years instead of every 2 years, which that's a win at least.
That is a big win, yeah. It's ridiculous, especially in this case. It's like, he's going to be denied, so why do we have to relive this every 2 years?
Yeah, it's really unfortunate. And there's, you know, we have a link to the last petition just so you can see what it looks like. I'm sure another petition will be created closer to that 2026 date.
Yeah.
But yeah, it sucks they have to continue to get public support to try to keep this guy in. I mean, I hope that the parole board, just with or without the support, would just do the right thing and keep this guy behind bars, because he is a danger to society. And anybody that does this heinous of a crime, especially against children, I just have no sympathy for whatsoever.
Yeah.
And I think he's right where he belongs.
Yeah, agreed. No argument there. But man, this whole case, what a trip. I'm still torn on incompetence or cover up.
Conspiracy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really hard to say. I just don't know if there's enough evidence to prove anything beyond what we know.
And unfortunately, with cover-ups, especially police cover-ups,
they're the hardest.
It's destroyed evidence. Right. You'll never find
they're it. They're the hardest to prove for sure. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm just glad that they did find him and they did get him put away. But I mean, that doesn't really do much for the family at this point. And, you know, my heart goes out to them for everything they've been through and just how much pain and trauma to have to relive this every couple of years. I mean, that's really, really difficult to deal with and something no one should have to deal with. But yeah, I have not much else to say. It was a really heavy one, but definitely want to know your thoughts on this case. You know, do you think that there's more to the story here involving the authorities possibly, or do you believe David's story? Do you believe, you know, everything that he said was true, or do you think he was kind of living in this fantasy world and, you know, kind of just made all this stuff up that he said happened that really didn't? But that is going to be it for us today. If you would hit that subscribe button on YouTube or Apple Podcasts, we'd greatly appreciate it. Spotify has been doing excellent in the Spotify charts lately, thanks to you. We really appreciate it. It just helps the show get seen by more people, and it makes us feel good. I mean, I'm not going to lie.
Yeah.
It's a win.
Yeah. I like seeing the numbers.
Yeah.
I like to see us go up the charts. It's fun.
It's really cool. It's honestly really cool to see how far the show's come, and I'm really excited to see where it goes. And we've got a lot of cool things in the works, and thanks to Tom for helping us out today while Danny's at home in his cozy warm bed.
No. Shit in his pants.
You know, he'll be back next week. He's doing well, but we'll see you guys next time. And until then, lights out, everybody.